Welcome to the Doubles Only Tennis Podcast, where you learn the best doubles strategies to improve your game and win more matches. I'm your host, Will Bocek. This podcast, my website, and my weekly newsletter all focus on the goal of better understanding the sport of doubles and helping players like you improve faster through actionable advice that you can use in your very next match. My goal is to provide the best doubles strategy resources in the world. And to do that, I study, analyze, and work with players at every level of the game, all the way up to the ATP and WTA tours. If you enjoy this podcast, I've created double strategy products that go even deeper if you want to take your doubles knowledge to the next level. At the end of this episode, I'll explain more about them, or if you want to learn more now, go to thetennistribe.com/products. Here's today's episode. In today's episode, I interview Coach Joel Myers. Joel is a USPTA elite professional. He won the 2021 USPTA San Diego Pro of the Year, and he's the tennis director at Coronado Tennis Center in San Diego. And I reached out to Joel because I've followed him for a while on Twitter, but he shares a lot of his lessons on Instagram, where he has over 115,000 followers. So I really like these lessons a lot with coaches that are also very active on some of these social platforms online, because what these social platforms do, like Instagram or YouTube, is they force you to consolidate your lessons in a very concise way. And it makes it a lot more applicable to you as the tennis player and as the student. So anybody who has over 100,000 followers on Instagram obviously is doing something right. So I reached out to Joel. We had a really great conversation all about tennis strategy as well as a little bit of technique. So in this episode, we cover some doubles tips from his Instagram channel. He actually has a highlight called Doubles Tips that I highly recommend. We talk about his tennis story. He's from Australia. It seemed like he was maybe on a path to a pro career before having an injury. So he talks a little bit about that. And then we talk about strategy. So we talk about different skill sets that 3-5 and 4-0 players need, which is a lot of who he is coaching on a regular basis. We talk about how to develop more confidence at the net, including volley technique, mistakes, and drills. We talk about how to beat pushers, how to win with a weak doubles partner, and a lot more. So again, I think these episodes with some of these coaches who are doing a lot online, you can learn a ton from them. I know a lot of you found me through Instagram or YouTube or just people referring to you to the podcast. And this is a great way to learn from others who are doing a really good job of coaching online as well. So without further delay, enjoy this strategy episode with Joel Myers. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. Today we have Coach Joel Myers on. Joel, welcome.
Hey, Will, thanks for having me.
So I wanted to start with your Instagram channel because you've got over 100,000 followers on Instagram. So obviously you're producing a lot of good content there. So I was going through some of it earlier, and at the top, you've got your highlights and one of them is called Doubles Tips. So first off, everybody listening, I highly recommend you go to his Instagram channel and check out these doubles tips and follow him. But also, I wanted to ask specifically about a few of these. So the first one is about how to split up the court. What are the big mistakes you see at the club level in terms of how to split up the court? And then how do we fix or correct that?
Yeah, I think splitting up the court for most players, they look at the center line. And for us who coach doubles, you know, it's really common that we're always, you know, telling our players at the net, don't be so concerned about the line. Don't worry about the alley so much. But when you look at the way, you know, a doubles court really is best split, it's sort of cut like a sandwich from the net post to the corner. So let's say the player's on the ad side of the net. The net player is going to cover from the right net post to sort of just like the depth line of the ad court. Yeah, and it's cut at a diagonal angle. So the back player covers lobs. The front player has access to the balls that go through the middle. they're really not concerned so much about the alley. I think players really overcover the alley, especially at a 3-5 to 4-5 level. So mm-hmm. the way they need to split it is a lot more corner to corner like a sandwich and trying to think about the airspace you're trying to cover, especially as a front player.
Yeah. Yeah. And as I've spent more time on court myself this year, you know, historically I've mostly been online, and I've been trying to come up with like better and better ways to articulate this to players because, yeah. you know, sometimes they'll say it one way and then they'll go out there and play their match and then nothing changes. And it's like, they seem to get it, but they're not implementing it. And I guess a lot of it does have to do with just, you know, I'm going to play the do side, you're going to play the add side. So then we think like, okay, well, during the point, I'm either covering the do side or the add side, but that's really not how good doubles is played.
Yeah, I think it's just such a fear that you're going to look bad. Your side of the court's going to look bad, you know, and I think you've got to remember that doubles is a team game. And if, you know, I'm the net player and you're my opponent at the baseline, you're blasting balls down the line. I mean, number one, my partner has to hit a decent enough ball that it makes it hard for you to go down the line. So, you know, that's number one. It has to be a tough ball for you to go down the line on. Number two, I have to be watching you so I can recognize when you have the opportunity to go down the line. You know, number three, I need to disguise my movement. If I'm, you know, telegraphing my move, my poke early, and you see that, you're going to pull the trigger down the line. And then, you know, four, and this is the hardest for club level players, is that sometimes the shot is just too good or the player gets lucky. And you have to understand that that doesn't mean that you go cover that line for the rest of the match. You're trying to play what's going to happen most of the time, not what's going to happen a little bit of the time, even though sometimes what happens a little bit of the time makes you feel really bad at the net and like you've let your partner down.
Right. Yeah, that's a lesson I try to tell a lot of people. I'll see it all the time. They'll play a perfect point and lose the point, and one of them will say to their partner, "Oh, my bad." And I'll go interrupt them and say, no, you didn't do anything wrong there. If y'all play that exact same point 10 times, you're going to win 6 or 7 of them, and that's perfect. So that's a really, really good lesson there. So another highlight from that doubles tip section was the staggered formation. And this is something that the listeners, you know, if they've been listening to the show a while, they'll be pretty familiar with. I talk a lot about how to use that stagger formation to help cover the lob because the lob is so prevalent at the club level. But the example you use, I think, is probably the best example I've ever seen because they actually shift their stagger formation up and back according to where the ball is. So talk a little bit about the stagger formation and how we should be using it at the club level.
Yeah, so let's say you and I are coming to the – or I'm at the net and you're on the juice side coming to the net. When you come in level with me or next to me, we don't really know who's going to take that center ball, so there's confusion there. But also, if the opponent gets a lob over the top of your head, I can't help. Once you get really close to the net and the cross-court lob is an option for your opponent, if they can see that and hit that, we're sort of dead in the water. So coming up to staggered formation means that you're the juice court player, I'm the ad court player, you've approached the net, and you're going to come to the net just a little bit inside the service line. I'm going to be front and center in the ad court box, and I'm hunting everything through the middle. You're back there to provide lob support if that happens, but also to, you know, make sure that anything that is an option for you to move in and to knock off, you'll do that too. But it really helps us to cover the ball that otherwise would be just an easy lob that's going to go over the top. And when you play players and other teams that love to lob, you can play that stagger a little bit further back. But maybe that front player isn't crushing the net as much. Maybe they're slightly more back, and maybe that back player is staggered a little bit further back, just predicting that a lob is more likely to come.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's one of the things I liked about the way you explained that lesson was you're giving up the two lowest percentage shots, which are down the line lob, right? You don't want to give them the cross court lob because they have so much more court to hit into. And then that sharp angle is really low percentage as well. So you're kind of giving that
exactly.
up.
Exactly. You're covering the highest percentage shots that are going to be hit. So you're mm-hmm. forcing your opponent into the lowest percentage shot, which is always going to be, in the long run, it's going to be in your favor. So yeah, that's definitely the way you want to do that when you come in.
Right. And this is all of these tactics I tell people, like these are great places to start and then of course adjust accordingly. I've certainly had matches where I've played players who love their cross court angle roll forehand. And it's like, okay, I've got to make an adjustment here. So one other Instagram highlight here that I actually kind of want to challenge you on. So I'm going to see if I can convince you to change your mind on this, or you can convince me to change my mind. So you had some screenshots of several tweets that had some really good lessons on serve, net play, return strategy, all sorts of stuff. But one of the things that I've done some lessons on this year, and this is actually probably the most controversial subject that I've created content on, is starting with the best returner on the ad side. That something you still believe, or is it something you've changed your mind on? Explain it a little bit for us.
So I've made content in the past where I think if you're playing standard formation, then you recognize that 75% of game points are on the ad side. So considering how short a rally length is in doubles, I think it's around 2.7 shots, you want to put your best returner on the ad side so that you can get the point started when it matters the most. Since if you're playing standard formation, only 40, 15 and 15, 40 are going to be game ending points. Obviously that changes completely if it's sudden death juice, but there are other factors too. And I think, you know, you'll probably bring those up, like the better volley being in the middle, the better return of serve, maybe your forehand return of serve is better. So you want to put that on the ad side because more serves are going to come through the tee as the server's trying to set the partner up. But that's where that thought process comes from, is to put the better player on the ad side where most of the game points are going to be, where the pressure points are going to be, to get the point started.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that makes sense to me. I mean, the one thing... So this was a couple years back at this point, but I had Steve Smith on the show, and he first talked about this to me, where the deuce court player is going to end up with more total returns in the match. So you'd rather have your better player taking more of the returns. And then, of course, with that, like if your deuce court player is stronger, you're more likely to get that 30-40 point versus... If you have your weaker player than the deuce court, you're more likely to be down 30-40 and not see as many break points. I think I read that you majored in psychology, so maybe you'll know more about this, but I want to see more data on how the weaker player performs on big points. Because if they see a drop in performance on big points, then I would agree to leave the stronger player on the ad side. But if they win the same percentage of points on big points as they do normal points, then I think this kind of goes out the window and it's like return wherever y'all think is best.
Yeah.
Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you put the better player, and it's hard saying better player because I have been the better player with the weaker returner and played the juice court just because my return wasn't the strength of my game. So I think it depends on the doubles team, but from a purely analytical, like important point standpoint, that's what sort of sticks out. If you've got somebody who is, better, like you were saying, better under pressure, even if you're down, even if you regularly get game point down, you get a better chance to hold. But then I do see the argument on the other side where you need that juice court player to get the advantage, and then you have a better backhand volley in the middle, stronger shots from the center of the court. So. It's more complicated than it seems. It does seem easy just to give the statistics of 75%. But I guess team by team basis, you got to analyze that. I'm still a 50-50 on which one I prefer, to be honest. But I do like the thought of getting the ball started, getting the player that has the better return in play that we can convert or save a game point.
Yeah. And I think another point to make, and then we'll change subjects, is that this isn't the only factor that we should be taking into account when we're choosing return sides. So a lot of times it's best to return with strengths in the middle. So if you've got a lefty, you might go forehands in the middle, regardless of if you return better on the other side. Yeah. Or if, like you said earlier, one player's better at the net with the other at the baseline, then you want to consider having their forehand volley in the middle or whatever their strongest volley is. There's other factors. This is the factor that I feel like people maybe put too much weight on because it's such a kind of controversial debate. So they ultimately just ride or die by my best returners in the ad or my best returners in the deuce, but they need to be considering a lot more than just who is your best returner.
And also the opponent. If the opponent makes a lot of first serves, you know, and they're mm-hmm. consistently making first serves, that puts more emphasis on the return. If the sure. opponent is a bit of a bomb or balloon player where they miss the bomb and they have to hit the balloon more often, then it's maybe not as important because that slower second serve is much easier to get in play. So it also depends mm-hmm. on the other team you're playing, and you can make that adjustment after the first set anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Because like for myself, I usually return on the ad side because I have a good cross court backhand return. But if somebody has a really good first serve down the tee, they can rush my forehand and get me a lot of forehand return errors.
It's so tough. Yeah, it's so tough.
So in that case, like I might be better on the deuce side and force them to hit a slice serve to my forehand where my forehand has more time. And I have a really good forehand cross court return from the deuce side if I have time to hit it. But a lot of players don't have that fast pace forehand to the ad side, and they just try to hit to my backhand anyways because we're taught to serve to the backhand, or I guess a lot of people are. So
it's a complex topic. Yeah, it is, and it depends on the level you're playing at as well. It becomes more important. Mm-hmm. The return and stuff becomes more important as players get more serves in at a higher pace. You can't just miss returns. And we know that in doubles, you've got to make a high clip of first serves and you've got to make a high clip of returns, especially first serve returns. Second mm-hmm. serve returns are typically your opportunity. So, you know, that's the time where you're favored. But, mm-hmm. Doubles returning is so tough. I mean, you've got such a small window to get the ball in play. You've got a hunting net player looking to take any floating return and tag your partner. So you feel the pressure of not just playing a super defensive return or your partner gets killed. Or going too aggressive and missing a ton. So doubles returning is tough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is. It's under-practiced as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to get back to some strategy and even a few technical questions. But tell us your tennis story. How did you get started? I know you're from Melbourne and then now you're in San Diego. What kind of happened in between there?
Yeah, so I was a decent junior. I moved to Melbourne to further my tennis when I was a young player. And then I spent most of my days training there at Melbourne Park. It was an amazing experience. I get to see a lot of Australian Opens, a lot of pros come and go. I get to be inspired by that quality of tennis. I always wanted to play pro myself. And then around 18, I suffered a shoulder injury. I played an Aussie Rules football match and I tore my shoulder out. So I was out for a year. And in that year, I didn't play, so I sort of my next step was to try and get to college, and not many colleges really wanted to touch me after a shoulder injury. So I ended up finally settling and going in Point Loma here in San Diego, and I spent 4 years here. I studied psychology. I was decent in college as a player, and then I decided that I wanted to start my coaching career and did that for 10 years. And 3 years ago, I became the tennis director here for the municipal facilities here in Coronado. So we run all the tennis programs here on city courts.
Mm-hmm. Where were you before Melbourne? Where were you born?
I was born in Sydney, and then I moved to Melbourne around 11.
Okay. And did your family kind of play tennis and stuff, and that's how you got started in it?
No, you know, my grandfather did. Not that I actually knew that, but I loved hitting the ball against the wall, watching Wimbledon. And I just really liked the individual aspect of tennis, that if I played well and I won, I earned the result. And if I lost, I earned that result as well. So I just really love the athleticism. I grew up watching some of the big servers. I love the power game. But yeah, it was just really fun. It's just, tennis is so much fun. Yeah, chasing the ball around, smacking it over the net. It was great.
Yeah. So I was reading your bio on your website, and one of the quotes here that stood out to me was, "When you work with me, you will know why you're making a change or why a certain strategy is important." Talk about the importance of teaching that why to your students.
Well, the why is for buy-in, and whether it's for the player or the parent, I'll give you an example. A lot of juniors have Western grips, and they learn to deal with high balls above the shoulder with a Western grip. It could be a forehand. And what they don't look at is, in the future, they say, "I want to get to a certain level of tennis." And you go, "Okay, well, at that level, this is what's going to happen. The ball's going to come faster and deeper. And here are the fundamental things that have to happen for you to hit that forehand well. And the more inefficiencies there are in your technique in that area, the harder it's going to be for you to get to that level and be effective. So you need to win them over with the why. You need to show them why it's important. And the more that they buy in, the quicker they make that change. It's really tough to get players to buy in if they don't understand the why. And I think you want students that are involved in that process that ask smart questions. You involve the parents as much as you can to make sure that they can enforce those when you're not around, because obviously I'm not around all the time for the kids. But understanding the why is huge. And I think players that really love tennis, they want to know why. They want to know why you need to learn how to serve and volley. They want to know why you have to practice first volleys around the service line. So these things are important. And with the more you get buy-in, the more results you get.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense. And it'll, I would imagine it would motivate the player while they're working on the thing, right? And you'll get faster results when they really understand what's going on as well. I have a theory that I kind of want to run by you. So do you think, when I was reading your bio, you mentioned strategy a few times. Do you think that too many coaches focus too much on technique and not enough on strategy?
I think that they're both so intertwined. I think if you have certain technical flaws, then you won't be able to use certain strategies.
Right.
So, you know, on a base element, you need to have pretty efficient technique, and which allows you to do a lot of different things tactically. Mm-hmm. And if you have something that, you know, if you have something that is absolutely hemorrhaging points, or something that you simply can't come to the net because, you know, your backswing is so big that you have to stop before you hit your approach shot, and then you don't get to come to the net, so you have to hit a volley further behind the service line. If things like that aren't fixed, then you're not going to have the ability to problem solve and use different tools in a match to beat somebody or to beat another doubles team. So I think they're really intertwined, and I think the coaches maybe look a lot that's at a style rather than fundamentals. I think the fundamentals are the things that make technique efficient. So there are certain things players are going to gravitate to doing that you don't need to overcoach, but fundamental elements of swings and swing paths and stuff, they need to be hit in order for players to be able to execute these certain swings and certain shots, and then to be able to use the strategy against other players.
Mm-hmm. What about for like a typical club player? So let's say it's like a 40 or 50 year old adult who's playing 4 hours a week, right? And it's maybe a 3-0 or 3-5 person who's, you know, they're playing for their local league, but they're not really trying to develop their game and get to like a 4-5-5-0 level. I feel like at a certain point, it's like, okay, we're not fixing your pancake grip on your serve, or like, it's just not going to happen. So how do you manage that?
Well, I think personally, you've got to ask the client what their goal is. The first question that is for me is like, what do you want to do with tennis? Like, are you a competitive player? Are you a doubles player? Do you just want to come out and bang balls and get a great workout? Are you here to be social? You know, it depends on what their goal is. But if you've got a player that's like, you know, I can't make a forehand return in the court, and you go and look at their technique and their Western grip, taking the racket, you know, above their head, I think you've got to address that technically. The other thing that I think that I notice a lot with club players between 3-0 and 4-0 is just they don't manage their contact points very well. And so you might have decent technique, or maybe you got something a little bit funky, but you'll miss the contact point trying to get that swing in. And I think one of the biggest indicators of this in doubles is where the cross court lob comes in and you see that baseline player back off the baseline so they can fit their swing in, instead of shortening the swing and just holding better court position and having good contact point. You see that all the time. And I think that's one of the key skills for doubles players, is to be able to shorten a swing up, manage the contact point. And it gives them all sorts of options strategically as well, like taking the ball out of the air or on the rise. But it is hard to change technique, especially if it's been ingrained. But I think it just comes down to what the player wants to do. I think with adults, because they have such limited time to practice, and maybe they play in a clinic, a doubles clinic, and then they have their matches, and it's a really tough way to work on strategy. If you can get some friendly match play in there against some other players, and you can work on tactics and strategy and things that you're not super comfortable with, that'll go a long way to developing some confidence that you can use in matches. That's something mm-hmm. that I think adults probably don't use enough of.
Yeah. Oh, well, so when you say contact point, do you mean like the height of the ball when we're making contact, or do you mean like letting it come to you to get into your hitting zone, or some combination of both?
Yeah, so sort of a combination of both. So, you know, the optimum contact point for your forehand and where that needs to be. So mm-hmm. that if you hit a high ball to me, I move back and hit it, I hit it on the rise, but I'm going to hit it at that common contact point that I'm familiar with, rather than me, you know, getting my crazy wind up and trying to make all that happen and then sacrifice that contact point for a less quality shot. So I think a lot of players sort of make that mistake. They almost need to reverse engineer their swings and go, okay, here's where contact needs to be. And then however much time I have to get to that point, that's how big the swing can be.
Mm. Yeah, I like that a lot. Yeah, the other area I see that a lot is when they are, I actually just did a podcast on this last week, but when they're transitioning to the net, a lot of players really don't want to let the ball drop. So they'll reach so far forward and hit this just really terrible volley that they'll usually miss or pop it up for the opposing team because they're trying to reach forward for the ball rather than just letting it come to them and staying patient as they move forward.
Yeah. And I think, absolutely. I think the volleying at the net too is it's so much about movement and so much less about the stroke. If you can move well at the net, then you can volley well, because you get two main sources of power are going to be from your opponent's shot. Just by blocking, you get about 50% of your opponent's pace coming back off your string bed, and then your momentum. So when you're moving forward, you know, whether that be before a poach or before, you know, holding your ground and staying home at the net in doubles, you're going to get momentum and pop from that volley just from moving forward. Not to mention you get to hit that volley at a higher contact point and you get to cut down on their angle as well. So lots of benefits to moving forward. I think for a lot of club players, it's those that's not getting that volley, and it's the recovery back to home base and doing it again, because you need to be really active as a good net player in doubles with your movement and your recovery if you don't get that volley.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like I tell a lot of people, more so with volleys than ground strokes, when they miss it with their feet and their lower body rather than their upper body or their swing. I mean, there's of course the occasional players who take too big of a backswing, but a lot of times if you fix the footwork, it kind of fixes everything else.
Yes.
So before the call, you messaged me about skill sets for 3-5 and 4-0 doubles players. So let's go through those now.
Yeah. So there's a lot of things that I try and week by week work on players to get their confidence up, because you'll find that they get into certain modes where they won't take a ball on the rise. They won't take it out of the air, and they're just really scared to fail doing that. And some of the skill sets that we work on are swing volleys or drive volleys, depending where you're from. Taking the ball on the rise. And this is, like I was saying earlier, like managing your contact point. You have to do that to do some of these things. But that gives you an advantage, especially against the moon baller. I think everybody is going to struggle against the moon baller. And, you know, having these offensive weapons gives you a chance to sort of break up their rhythm and break up their momentum a little bit. But I like to tell my players to make sure that they're doing that when they're up in the scoreboard. I think many players don't really use the scoreboard well to determine how much risk they can take. And if you are ahead a little bit, that's the time where maybe you take somebody's lob cross court out of the air as a swing volley, drive it right through the middle. And if you miss, at least you're sending the message that you're ready to take that ball on occasionally. And it just keeps the threat of that in the back of your opponent's head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely a really good skill to have. One thing I want to highlight, and you can talk more about, is you said the point score matters. So if they hit that lob cross court, you take that swinging volley, you said through the middle of the court. Why through the middle of the court?
So, you know, a swing volley is high risk. It's a very aggressive shot. Typically, the net player is not going to look to poach that. But if you aim at the middle and you catch that ball early, high chance that's still going to go in cross court. If you catch that ball late, like many of us do, it's going to go right at the net player, which has a great effect as well. So the importance of the targets and a big target on such an aggressive shot is really important. If you're really trying to thread the needle cross court on that and you catch it early, you're going to send it wide. So I think that's where the bigger you go with the shot, the less the net player is going to be an influence, especially at, you know, the 3-5 to 4-0 level. And you're going to make more of those balls in. And if you do hit it right in the middle, that's a great ball. That's a really good chance that you're going to set your net player up for a volley.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely is. And I think when we go through, like, you know, you've seen a lot of coaches have like the ways to force an error where you can use like height, direction, spin, speed, all these things. But my favorite one that I teach to doubles players is time, just like taking time away from the opponent. And of course, they're related. So you can do that by hitting with more speed or by stepping forward. And we're talking about stepping forward here. So taking the ball on the rise and early is going to take time away from the opponent. And then also these swinging volleys are taking time away from the opponent by not even letting it bounce. And when we're doing that, we're not focused on hitting it hard. We're just going to let by shrinking the path that the ball has to travel, that's how we're going to take away the time. So we don't have to hit harder.
Absolutely. And that's where, again, if that's something that you know you're getting lobbed to death cross court, and or it could be down the line if you can get there. But taking a swing volley might be something you do when you're up. So you decide to put a bit more pace on it, attack with more power. But if it's a more important point, maybe you take just a standard volley, and that one will have to go a little bit more cross court. But it doesn't have to have, like you're saying, the pace on it to have an effect. You're sending it back, you know, almost twice as fast by not letting it bounce. And that's where sometimes some of those volleys where you play them just cross court short, it doesn't allow the baseliner to get back into another lob. So it can be really effective. But you can determine the type of ball out of the air you hit based on the score, but you are committed to taking it out of the air. And I think that's something that you want to definitely work on as a 3-5, 3-0, 4-0 player.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like I'd almost never see that at that level too. I really like the idea of teaching that because it sounds very doable and super effective against some of the teams that people tell me are annoying to play, which is like the pushers and the lobbers, right? So
I think one of the things with a lobber is, like, you know, they're predictable. So, you know, if they lob you cross and you lob back cross, you can almost guarantee a lob's coming. So I do something in some of my clinics where I'll have a feed to somebody who has to lob, and the this side of the court where I've fed from will creep in a little bit, and, you know, maybe 2 feet inside the baseline, and they're determined to take that next ball out of the air, and then we play it live. So it could be a swing volley from them, or the ball could be dropping short and they come in, and if it's really short, they'll take a ground stroke. But if it's, you know, shorter, they can come in and take a standard volley if the ball's dropping. But it just brings that ball down to a lower level, and it really rushes the player that likes that time to get that moon ball off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. What other skill sets do you like to teach your 3-5, 4-0 level players?
So something that really kills me when I watch some of the USTA doubles leagues is second serves and letting them drop from the peak. So you know, it just kills me. So you see a first serve return position on the baseline. The server misses the first serve, and then they don't really move in off that next ball. This weak second serve comes in, it peaks, and it drops under the net. And now you've got a situation where if the player decides to be aggressive, they're trying to be aggressive from below the level of the net where it's a massive obstacle, and they usually don't have the spin to bring that ball back down in the court. So they'll send it long, or they'll send it in the net. But really, that's solved by putting a premium on contact point above the net. So standing in a lot closer, taking that ball even with a shorter backswing, and sometimes the serves are that weak that you sort of have to come to the net, and you've got to approach. But you really lose such a massive advantage in the doubles court once you let the ball drop below the level of the net. You've got to hit up again, which, as we know, it brings the net player into play, brings your opponent's net player into play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially on second serves, it's you've got to take advantage of those points.
You have to. And then I think that your 3-0 to 4-0 level, if you also have the ability to develop a good slice, and that could be a chip and charge, that could also be a short slice and approach. Mm-hmm. Because some of these serves, we're talking, they're really quite short in the box, they're short in the court, and you're almost dragged in on the approach. But the ability to have a slice and even a short slice the opponent can't distinguish which one is coming, you can wreak havoc with that server where you can drive the slice, you know, deeper and put them under a little bit of pressure that way. Or moving in, you can hit it short and try and set your net player up. But it's another way that you can use the front of the court and disguise it well, because it's very hard to tell what's coming off that wing, off a slice. Hmm.
I like that a lot. So you can, so for people listening, you can set up a drill with your coach or your doubles partner and just have them feed short second serves and just practice those slices and have a target deep cross court and then have a target short cross court and just alternate that depth. Cause you'll face, you face so many players at that level who, you know, I mean, we're all getting older, so some of us don't have as much speed. So a lot of the servers, almost everybody's serving and staying back, especially on a second serve. So a lot of them are not going to be able to get up to that short one. And then if you give them a few of those, they'll serve, come forward, and then you can give them the deep one. That's I like that a lot. That's really good.
It's good, good variety. I do think that if you move forward aggressively, and you have to make it look like you might go down the line, because when you hit a slice, they sometimes have a tendency to float. And if the net player can read you, they can have some success there. So you've got to occasionally, you know, sometimes take it down the line, but you pre-plan that. But you always have to take that, moving up to that ball, make it look like you're dangerous going down the line. It just keeps that net player off the center of the net when you're moving forward against the second serve.
Mm-hmm. Well, when should we be going down the line as the returner?
I think second serves a great option early in the match. Send the message. You know, I think we all, even when you've been told this so many times, and I think it's really funny. Some of the clinics that I've had for years now is I tell my players, if you get beaten down the line, don't move off that home base spot in the center of the box. But everybody has that tendency when they've been beaten down the line to move over and watch that alley. And so I think early in the match, you can send the tone by driving it right down the line. And I like to tell the players that I work with, you got to hit it above the net. So like we just talked about, but aiming at the singles line. The singles line is a great guide because, you know, the alley's only 4.5 feet wide. So if you're a little bit off there, you have some margin. If you hit it well there and the net player misses that volley, you also have the added bonus of sort of chipping away a little bit at their confidence, the net, which is great in the long term. But I think early in the match, I think up in the score, times like that where the point is not really important because it is a higher risk shot. And if the net player, if it's a lower ball and the net player has a decent volley, then they'll knock off that volley through the middle of the court. So it can put you out of position real quick if you don't execute well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Really good advice. I like all those times to go down the line for sure. So any other skill sets you want to cover for this level player?
I think, you know, cross court lob is such a handy shot to have if you've got that on lock. I mean, I think it takes the net player out. And then like we were talking about, not many players like to take the ball on the riser out of the air. And if you are playing against somebody that doesn't have that ability, then you can basically push them back at will with a good cross court lob. And that then can turn offensive for you. If I'm the baseline player and Will, you're at the net, and I lob cross court to the opponent and they back up all the time, you're activated for any short cross. So, you know, but the difference in that lob is it's not a defensive lob that is very much an up and down lob to give us time to get back in the point. It's a lower arcing lob, more, I guess, like a moon ball that would push the baseliner back. And that's really what gets you involved if you want to look for a poaching chance, because it's going to be really hard to drive that ball down the line the further back they go behind the baseline. Or then I can come in and take it out of the air if that's my intent. And then you can run that as like a two ball pattern. We do get into a rally, I can lob cross, look to come in and do what we said earlier with the drive volley or the swing volley and take it out of the air and set myself up for some offense if I can't set you up. But that's an advantage of that cross court lob. Takes the net player out, and if you've got an opponent that doesn't like coming forward, then you can set yourself up.
Okay. So if we're using that, obviously against an aggressive net player, that's going to be pretty effective. It's a good way to come forward, right? So you lob, you come forward, either you have a volley or a swinging volley, or you can probably get all the way to the net in a lot of cases. Does it change for the deuce versus ad court? Since in the deuce court, our opponent at the net has a forehand volley in the middle. In the ad court, their forehand volley's down the line. So we're going cross court to a backhand. How does that change?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely can. The ad court has more, I mean, the ad court, you'll have more success because that high backhand volley is not effective. And then if you can get to the opponent's backhand, you're setting up usually a weak ball. But on the juice side to a righty, I think a lot of people don't necessarily think about lobbing a little bit more center when they go across as well, which limits the angle. So that's something where you can, if you can lob down the center, if you have that control, obviously that's It's a little bit shorter of a court, so a tougher ball. But lobbing down the center of the court can give no return angle, as long as, you know, the net player is not camped back on the service line with an overhead ready to kill your partner. But that's an option. That is an option. It's just a lot stronger of a shot over there with the forehand above the shoulder.
Sure. Yeah. And then I think if you're taking it from through the center from the deuce court, you're trying to get to the baseline player's backhand, which is an advantage. But I think one of the keys to executing that is not only the depth of the lob, you have to be good at getting that depth right, but also just studying, and this is where communication with your partner comes into play, studying how close that net player is to the net. Because if your partner can tell you between points, hey, like during the rally, they are super close to the net, like go for the lob through the middle of the court and come in behind it, and they're not going to have any angles. They're not going to be able to do anything. But if they are a little further back, obviously the lob's got to be even better. So it's a little bit riskier. So, so I wanted to ask about three more questions and then we'll do some rapid fire. Did you have any more skill sets you wanted to go over?
I think they were some of the main ones that I had on the top of my head that we work a lot on.
Okay. So we've talked a little bit about this. Actually, I'm going to skip that one. Let's go. How do we win with a weak doubles partner? It's a very common question I get. I don't know if people who play doubles just have huge egos and they blame it all on their partners every time, or if it's really a thing. But how do we win with a weak doubles partner?
You can only take care. You can only take care of all the things that are in your control, and I think you've got to find a way to really boost your partner's confidence up. And I think sometimes you play with a weaker partner and they miss, and you know, you give negative body language because you want everybody else to know that you're the best player on the court and you're not the one that is making you guys lose or miss. So I think like being a good doubles partner means that you pick your partner up, because even when you have two level partners, you're going to need to boost each other's confidence, boost each other in terms of like tennis, what the goal is on the court, the tennis knowledge, what we're trying to do. But you have to take care of your serves. You have to take care of all your return points. You don't have to do it all. But I think you do have to find and put your partner in a position where they can be successful. So what are their strengths? Maybe my partner's really weak at the net. Maybe we play a lot of two back on return. Maybe even we play two back on my second serve where they're going to be attacked more. You know, you make adjustments just to try and put them in the best position to use the skill sets they have and to hide their weak ones. The other thing, I think that when you play with someone who's a little bit weaker, and obviously they're going to be the target, is you have to have so much more movement. You have to be so much more dangerous with your movement. If I'm playing with a weak player and I'm at the net, that other team knows I'm going to be trying to poach. I'm going to be trying to get as many balls as possible. And, you know, they're then really acutely aware of my movement and they're ready to pull the trigger down the line when I abandon my side of the court. So I think that's where faking comes in a ton. That's where, you know, educating your partner on really try and keep the ball more in the middle of the court so that I have a chance to get it. You know, things like that come into play. It is, you know, depending on the level of difference, it is very hard to do, but I think you do have to put your partner in the best place to use their strengths and then different strategies to sort of set yourself up to be as involved as you can.
Yeah, totally agree. I think it starts with what you led with there, which is build them up and have good body language. I mean, don't be negative if they miss a shot. I see that too often, and especially at our level, it's like, you know, this is adult league tennis. This is not we're not playing for money, most of us. So build them up for sure. Okay, so if I gave you, let's say, 1 month with a 3-5 player who's very timid at the net, and we have to develop their confidence at the net, what would you have them do for that month? And let's say they're doing 6 hours a week of practice.
Okay, that's plenty. Okay, first thing, we look at technique. We look at the way they move at the net. We get them confident at defending themselves. I think all players need to understand how they defend themselves when the ball comes at them. You're going to get hit at a lot in doubles, whether it's the poaching player or the baseline is coming after you. So you must learn how to defend your body with a backhand volley. forehand volley doesn't defend the body. So a lot of players out there who are listening, if you're forehand volley dominant, you're not going to be able to protect yourself with that forehand volley. It's actually dangerous. So that's number one, is getting comfortable at the net. Then number two is just looking at technique, making sure they're comfortable in a neutral grip or very close to neutral grip as possible. And then you go through a progression of drills and you start slowly and you basically just build up the pace. I mean, at some point you're going to have to get them comfortable with some speed coming in. But yeah, I think it starts with the technique fundamentals and using a progression to make it a little bit faster and a little bit faster. And then, I had a drill when I was growing up where the coach would serve it at me from the baseline and I was standing at the service line. You know, so at some point you do sort of have to get thrown into the fire and you realize, okay, I've got to keep my eye on the ball. I've got to keep a wide base that I can get out of the way if I have to. And I have to track that ball. I can't, you know, close my eyes, turn my head. That's where I lose sight of it and that's where I'm in danger. But, you know, I think I've had a lot of players that are really not that confident at the net and they almost get really scared being up there. And I think doing that work to protect the body, it really helps with the confidence so much. And then they're not so worried in those tight encounters.
Yeah. I like that serving at the net player from the baseline.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
like
fun. I mean, like
sink or swim.
Absolutely. You know, if you're a really good dog, a couple of D1 doubles players with a training block with me coming up in the next couple of weeks. And we're going to do that drill quite a bit where I'm going to serve, they'll be at the service line. Both of them at the same time, and I'm just going to be ripping serves at the service line, and they're going to be digging out first volleys, and the pace is not going to worry them. They're going to get down low, use my pace. So it is a really handy drill, and if you know you can take a serve coming from the, you know, a fair height and pace, you're fine on a ground throw.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the progression makes a lot of sense, and I think I want the listeners to think about that if they're trying to develop their own confidence. It's like you've got to be hitting a lot of these volleys to develop these defensive skills that you're talking about. So you need to get a basket of balls or a ball machine or something and just go out there and have somebody feed at you or have the ball machine go at you. And then each week or every couple of weeks, just up the pace and up the pace and up the pace. And of course you need to have the technique down like you talked about as well.
Yeah. It's so minimal though. I mean, I think people have to realize how much you get off just keeping the racket out in front and meeting it in the middle. If you can find the center of your racket, you get so much off that ball coming in.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so let's do a few rapid fire questions and then I'm going to let you go. What is your favorite tennis racket, or let's say your racket of choice right now?
Right now it would probably be the Head Gravity. I like the Head Gravity, the bigger head size on returns, something I didn't factor in when I was playing. I played with a heavy, small racket because I was all about, you know, holding serve, sacrificed a lot of return games, but I think the bigger head with the Head Gravity, higher sweet spot has been nice.
Awesome. Do you play with the pro version?
I do. And I'll be honest, I pick up anything that's in my bag. Sometimes I play with a wooden racket for fun, but.
Yeah. what's your favorite tennis book?
Favorite tennis book, I would say Winning Ugly is the one that got me interested in strategy. And from a technical standpoint, it'd be Tennis 2000, this one here. Oh, right behind me. That book's amazing. If you can find it on eBay, it's actually pretty hard to find.
Yeah, I haven't read that one.
The Tennis 2000 by Vic Braden.
Okay. Yeah, I've studied a good bit of his stuff, but have not read that. What is your favorite tournament?
Aussie Open. I've been there so much and I got to play on those courts.
Yeah. Are you going this year coming up?
I'm not, but I would like to get back there in the next couple of years.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I'm going to shoot for 2025 as well. I went 2020 just before COVID and absolutely loved it.
It's such a great time of year there in Melbourne. It's so inspiring for tennis.
Yeah. Really nice. So last question, how do we make doubles more popular?
How do we make it more popular? We start to promote the times that doubles is played on the TV. That would be a good start. You know, for doubles players, it's pretty hard to pick when doubles is going to be played. It's sort of like a random occurrence when you see it on the television. So, you know, I think there's got to be something where, you know, we can promote doubles, especially at the higher levels, a little bit better, have easier access for everybody to see it.
Yeah, Yeah, better marketing, better TV coverage, yes, for sure.
100%.
Awesome. Any final pieces of advice, requests of the audience, anything before we let you go?
No, thanks for having me. You know, you can find some of the stuff that I've done on Instagram. That's the place that I post most of my stuff. So it's Joel_Myers_tennis. Shoot me a message and let me know what you thought of the podcast. But Will, thanks so much for having me on. This is an amazing resource for doubles players. So I always recommend people listen to this podcast. I've learned a lot from you and as a medium for the knowledge that you've got on the internet. So thank you very much for doing this stuff.
Awesome. Yeah, I really appreciate that a lot. Thank you so much. And thanks everyone for listening. I'll link to everything in the show notes, including Joel's Instagram page and highlights, as well as his Twitter account and website. So check all that out. And thanks again, Joel, for hopping on with us.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Doubles Only podcast. If you're interested in diving deeper into any topics I discuss, I've created double strategy products that allow me to bring you more podcasts and other doubles content without relying on paid ads. I have ebooks and courses that help you make better strategic decisions during matches and become the smartest player on the court. Go to thetennistribe.com/products to learn more. You can also join my free weekly double strategy newsletter that includes video lessons and more on our homepage. If you want to connect, you can find me on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, or email me directly, will@thetennistribe.com.